Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Wednesday, the 11th of July, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Juneau Empire Managing Editor John Moses about the Empire. We'll also find out about Little League State Championship games with some girls and their coaches. Ed Reiter's Almanac Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies, low temperatures around 46 degrees, southeast winds 10 miles per hour in the evening, becoming light and variable. Mostly cloudy skies expected on Thursday with high temperatures around 64 degrees. Forecast for Friday looks like rain with high temperatures around 58 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some residents in the town of Pavilion, located on the Wind River Reservation, will now be eligible for water cistern systems, water holding tanks. Pavilion is at the center of an ongoing Environmental Protection Agency investigation on whether hydraulic fracturing has contaminated the town's drinking water. However, as Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Autone reports, the details of the project are unclear.
Under a project put together by Governor Matt Mead, some Pavilion residents will be eligible to have water cisterns installed at no cost by the state. The cisterns have been provided as an alternative source of water instead of using wells which may be contaminated. Karen Halverson is the storage tank program manager. She says people will be able to call her for more information.
I will take those names and addresses and pass them on to I don't even know who. You know, we just started the project. This is like my first week of involvement. So I don't know what the boundaries are. I don't know who's eligible, who's not. But there is a boundary map, and based on their addresses, they'll determine they being, I don't know if it's the governor's office or water development or DEQ, will determine the eligibility.
Halverson says she expects more information will be available shortly. Under Governor Matt Mead's project, some Pavilion residents will be eligible to have water cisterns installed at no cost by the state. Those who choose to participate will have to agree to allow the state to monitor and test their existing wells. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
A well-respected chief from Eagle Village, Alaska, was killed in a car accident in Anchorage last week. 71-year-old Isaac Junabee was known for his humor and smile. Junabee was one of the last Han language speakers. He recently began a master's degree focusing on traditional regalia. His wife, Sandy, says he did not start speaking English until the age of 9. As a child, she says, he wore the traditional clothing of the Han Athabascan tribe.
Isaac has written 2 books and tapes on the Han language, so it wouldn't be lost. It's really kind of a sad thing because it's gone. And he was so absolutely adamant about the fact that it had to survive. That's what he was doing his master's degree on. He was doing it on the preservation of the language, the land, and the people.
Junabee served in the Army and worked for the National Park Service. He struggled with alcohol for 25 years, but overcame his addiction. As chief of Eagle Village, Sandy Junabee says her late husband worked to achieve sobriety and to preserve traditional ways of life.
He was an incredibly wonderful man who dreamt just wonderful dreams for these people, that they would heal and that they would be whole, and that he came to help them. He wanted so much to be a help. After he got sober, that was the thing that I think drove him.
Isaac Junabee was the youngest first chief of Eagle Village. He went by the nickname Senator because of his love for politics. Junabee is being buried in Eagle Village today. Federal officials are hosting a basketball clinic tonight with Native youth at Isleta Pueblo in New Mexico. The Interior Secretary and Acting Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs will host the event to celebrate 1 year of the Let's Move in Indian Country initiative, which addresses childhood obesity. During this week in 1762, a Cherokee delegation as emissaries of peace met with King George III. The delegation met in the drawing room at St. James Palace in London. Last month, a Cherokee group commemorated the 250th anniversary of the meeting with a trip to England. The tour featured some of the same locations that the original delegation visited. The group included representatives of 3 federally recognized Cherokee tribes as ambassadors of goodwill to Great Britain. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guest today is John Moses, who's the managing editor of the Juneau Empire. John, thank you for coming by the station today.
Thank you for having me.
So exactly what does a managing editor do?
Well, with a paper this size, we do just about everything, from page layout and design to occasionally going out and covering stories. On 4th of July, I was out shooting pictures, updating the website, just about everything, staff development. I sit on the editorial board. So really, it's kind of a jack-of-all-trades job.
Cool. What's the basic hierarchy at the Empire?
Well, we have the publisher, and then there's a management team, which I'm on, that works with the publisher, heads of advertising, circulation, production, controller. We all meet weekly and discuss things and keep up with what's happening in each other's departments, and have some really good communication.
How many reporters do you have?
I have 4 reporters and 4 section editors who also write. There's a deputy managing editor, a photographer, and myself, so we've got about 11 people going around the newsroom at any time.
How many papers do you print each day?
4,000 daily, 5,000 on Sundays.
How much of those are... Go ahead.
I'm sorry?
How much of those are subscription versus street sales?
I wasn't able to find the circulation manager and find that out. I did look into some basic numbers, but we couldn't get that split.
More or less. Do you think they evenly split?
First rule of journalism is never guess if you don't know the answer.
What about internet readers?
We have a lot. I did bring some figures from last month. Individual page views, we had more than 1.4 million. Monthly dedicated users, 184,200. Those are people who just come to the website. Some of them use it heavily, may go to 20 articles, some may go to 1 article. We have a lot of users. Now, this month, somewhat fewer, but still roughly in the same numbers.
Can you tell me the path of a story from beginning instigation or phone call or tip to the finished piece on the paper?
Well, we have news meetings every Tuesday. Most of the stories are discussed then some come up otherwise. A reporter files a budget, and we talk together every day about developing news, and the reporter files the story. Ideally, it goes through 2 editors and a copy editor. Sometimes it just goes through the 2 editors. And send it to the paginator. Randy Spray just joined our staff, and so you might see a new, cleaner look to the paper because I was putting it together before. And we put it up, and as it goes to the printing press, it's also put up online, so it cycles through. We have a dual process.
How do you determine what goes on the front page or not?
Well, that's just a judgment call every day. And sometimes it changes 2 or 3 times a day. We'll be laying the front page out and something else will happen. And or it turns out one story doesn't come through or isn't as important as another. So sometimes you think there's going to be a meeting and suddenly the meeting's canceled. Then you move things around.
Where do you get parts of the paper that you don't generate locally?
Well, we have wire services like Associated Press. But we also have inserts from Athlon Sports. We have the comics that's put together for us and we print. Not too many outside things. We have basic news syndicates, and then we have some feature syndicates like Dear Abby.
I talked to some people yesterday involved with the bridge, and they were really appreciative that you were running the bridge column.
Well, people love the bridge column. That comes also from a feature syndicate.
What part of the paper do you get the most feedback from your readers?
Well, if you look at our online stats for what people actually go to, a lot of police and fire, anything having to do with public safety. But the sports department really generates a lot of discussion, and they may not always call and say that they're reading it, but anywhere you go in the community, people really appreciate Klaus Stolpe, your sports editor's coverage. He's always out there in the community. So I think that sports is probably one of the highest read parts of our paper.
One of my first jobs was with the LA Times, and I was not doing any editorial work. It was putting together the sections that make up the Sunday paper. It was about like 2 in the morning. Is that still done manually?
Only if things go wrong, generally. Sometimes we do have crews come in and put the whole paper together, but generally it's an automated process. If we have a big Sunday paper, it's done often in 2 bites where everything's put together, and then when we put the news, they wrap that around. It depends on the edition and the size.
How many ways has the Internet affected the news business?
Oh, it's a title shift from even 10 years ago, and I really like it because I'm not drowning in all these press releases. It's easy to send things electronically. You're not wasting paper. I had one office in San Francisco in 1987. I swear we heated the place with press releases. We had a fireplace in the middle. Heater didn't work so well. All the press releases we were done with went straight into the fireplace. Nowadays, everything's cleaner.
Besides the Internet, what changes have you seen since you've been involved with the newspaper business?
Well, the newspaper business is changing, constantly streamlining. When I came into the business, there would be larger departments, larger feature departments. Sometimes you'd have your own printing press in the back. Nowadays, at least in the lower 48, printing is concentrated. They've centralized everything. And newsrooms are really a lot more spread thin throughout the industry.
Now, the Empire also produces the Capital City Weekly. How close do you work with that staff?
Oh, well, my education reporter, Sarah Day, went over there as the managing editor. We were really happy when she moved off, and she's done a great job with the paper. We work and we talk together. We don't closely coordinate all of our coverage. They're an independent paper. We're an independent paper. We do work together on special projects, on tabloids sometimes. But we enjoy reading them, and we hope they enjoy reading us.
You got a degree in journalism from San Francisco University. What brought you into the world of newspapers?
Well, my family used to take 3-4 newspapers at a time. When my parents were growing up, they didn't speak English. Their parents came from Hungary, and they pretty much learned it going to school. My father went to school the first time, and he said, "These guys are speaking Polish. What's going on here?" And his dad said, "No, they're speaking English. You got to learn English." And they were born here. They were raised in the Midwest, and they thought reading and learning was very important. They would get all the papers they could. The nightly news would be on television during dinner, and it was just a point of pride. In fact, I learned to read from newspapers. My father basically taught me when I was young. I'd sit next to him, and he'd point out words, and I learned to read on the San Francisco Chronicle.
Talking to John Moses, managing editor, the editor of the Juneau Empire, what was your first job in newspapers?
Well, I was a sports editor, but I knew almost nothing about sports. I didn't know anything about football. The first thing I covered was a football game. Sports editor looked at me and said, try this. Just go and ask the coach, what happened, coach? And it always worked. But I did know basketball and had a lot of fun doing that. Eventually, they moved me into education reporting, and I stayed in Main News. I really became a journalist, though, just largely because of my exposure to newspapers, and it's just what I always wanted to do.
You worked in several Bay Area newspapers?
Yes, I did. And the most interesting was the San Francisco Independent, which was a startup, and we grew to a huge paper. We put out almost 1 million papers between Redwood City and San Francisco. That was a real learning experience over 6 years.
Your editorial work in the Marin Independent Journal led to reforms. What besides making money is a newspaper's function in a community?
Now, we believe firmly in community stewardship, in keeping an eye, a watchdog role, on informing, helping people get the word out about their projects, keeping active coverage on youth sports, and also emphasizing the positive in the community. There's plenty of negative news going out there, but we always look for the good stuff, too.
Do you believe in what they call advocacy journalism?
Well, I don't believe it has any place at the Empire. There are papers. The San Francisco Bay Guardian was always big on advocacy journalism. The publisher used to call me the mastodon of journalism because I didn't do that. But I don't think that's been the way print journalism has gone. I think if you're advocating for something, it should be on the opinion page.
What brought you to Alaska?
Well, we've had family living here since 1984, and I just kept hearing all the great tales of Alaska. The first time I came to visit, up until Keaton, I knew that this was the state I really wanted to live in. It's what I've been looking for. It took 10 years for us to figure out how to move up here, but we finally did move to Talkeetna.
And you worked in the newspaper up there?
I worked at the Frontiersman. And after a while, especially the fuel costs, I figured I'd better start working for myself because I couldn't afford to drive 75 miles both ways. We started the Alaska Pioneer Press, my wife and I. And Gail was the driving force between our success, for our success financially. I put the paper together. But after 3 years, it just wasn't a going concern up there. There wasn't enough business for me. I was competing against an established paper, so we shut it down. I came down here.
I've been talking to John Moses, managing editor of the Juneau Empire, about the Empire and his life in newspapers. John, anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Can't think of anything.
All right, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you.
this July 26th through the 29th. Prepare yourself for a fair like there's no tomorrow.
The Southeast Alaska State Fair has events for the entire family. Don't miss new activities like the Zombie Adventure Run. There's a wearable art fashion show debuting Saturday night. And all your fair favorites. The Haynes Hustle, Logging Show, Fisherman's Rodeo, Music Contest, and more.
Fair like there's no tomorrow.
July 26th through 29th at the Southeast Alaska State Fair.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 11th of July, 2012. It's the birthday of the artist best known for a painting of his mother, James Abbott McNeil Whistler, born in Lowell, Massachusetts, 1834, who once said, "I do not choose to be born in Lowell." And indeed, when he was 21 years old, he left for Paris and never returned to the United States. He had gone to West Point, where he was something of a rebel. He wore his hair longer than was allowed, and the superintendent, Robert E. Lee, at the time, eventually kicked him out. James Whistler, who believed in art for art's sake, unlike most Victorians, did not believe that art or artists had a responsibility to convey a moral message. And the painting known as Whistler's Mother, entitled Arrangement in Gray and Black Number 1, is a painting of his mother because Whistler's model, who was scheduled to come, did not show up. It's the birthday of E.B. White, Elwin Brooks White, born in Mount Vernon, New York, 1899, a writer for the New Yorker magazine for nearly 60 years. In 1938, he and his wife, Catherine Angel, left New York City, moved to a farm on the coast of Maine, where he wrote essays, his columns for Harper's, collected in the book One Man's Meat. He wrote his famous essay, Death of a Pig, in which he wrote, "I discovered that once, having given a pig an enema, there is no turning back, no chance of resuming one of life's more stereotyped roles. The pig's lot and mine were inextricably bound, as though the rubber tube were the silver cord." And a few years after that, he wrote his famous book, Charlotte's Web, about a pig who is saved by a little girl and a clever spider. In the summer of 1948, E.B. White, sitting in a hotel room at the Algonquin during a heat wave in the city, wrote his essay, Here is New York, in which he wrote, "On any person who desires such queer prizes, New York will bestow the gift of loneliness and the gift of privacy. No one should come to New York to live unless he is willing to be lucky." And it's the birthday of Jhumpa Lahiri, born in London, 1967, settled in America in Rhode Island, where her father was a librarian. On weekends, the family would get together with other Bengali families to cook Bengali food and speak Bengali and reminisce. And her first book, The Interpreter of Maladies, was a collection of 9 stories about Bengalis living in suburban New England. The book came out as a trade paperback in 1999 and won the Pulitzer Prize. Here's a poem for today by Katrina Vandenberg, Handwriting Analysis. On the first day of fourth grade, Mrs. Hunter collected our penmanship samples to save until June. By then, she said, we'd write in the handwriting we would have all our lives. Though she probably read that in a book on child development, I was so excited I could hardly stand it. In 9 months, my adult self would be born. She would send me a letter. In the ways she swooped, careened, and crossed her T's, I could read everything I would need to know. We were writing ourselves into the future. We came closer each time we turned the silver gears in the sharpener near the door, the wood shavings tumbling inside, smelling as if a house were being built. A poem by Katrina Vandenberg, Handwriting Analysis, from The Alphabet Not Unlike the World, published by Milkweed Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Phoebe Rohrbacher is our third speaker. Phoebe was born and raised in Juneau. Since graduating from college, she's been working with people with developmental disabilities and making art. And here's Phoebe.
Okay, can you hear me? It's too loud, maybe. Okay, I thought the theme was taking a trip somehow. I didn't know the theme was transitions, so I'm going to try to think on my feet. No, just kidding, I knew. Okay, transitions, you know, there's lots of kinds, whatever. Yes. Okay, I'm just going to jump into the story, okay, and you guys can kind of like fill in where's the transition element. Okay, so I was about 18, maybe 17. It was the summer between high school and college, and I really like to run a lot. So at that time, I was like, "Oh, I need to run. I'm so pent up. I'm an angsty teenager." And so we ate dinner, and I'm like, "Mom and Dad, I need to go running." And they're like, "Phoebe, it's about 7:30 in August. Like, it's not dark yet, but can you just promise us you'll go on the road? Because you shouldn't go in the woods by yourself." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, I promise. Okay, bye." And so I went out on my run. I was running down Douglas Highway, and I was like, "Oh, I'm really bored. I really wish I was in the woods right now." So I decided to go up into some neighborhoods. I was like, maybe that can satiate my need for the forest. So I'm running, and then I came across, I'm like up in this neighborhood called Forest Edge, which I was like, great, I'll be on the edge of the forest. So I see this tiny trail. I'm like, hey, no biggie. There's a little trail, and it goes down onto into the woods a little bit, but I can still see the neighborhood. So, Mom and Dad, they'll never know. So I was like running and running, and then soon I was just kind of walking, because there was no trail. It was just bushes and like Devil's Club. But I was like, I can still see all the, like that whole neighborhood. So I'm just gonna keep pushing through. So I'm like stepping over giant logs and like pushing. I'm like, I can hardly see those houses anymore, but I need to figure out how to. And then I'm like, I need to get out of here. Like all of a sudden, I was like, oh, wait a minute. I'm in the middle of a gully. Like, what? I'm, like, in Lawson Creek bed. I was like, how did I get here? Because there's houses back there, there's houses up there, but this is just, like, straight-up forest. I see what they mean when they say Forest Edge. So I'm starting to get nervous all of a sudden. I was like, oh, my God, it's 7:30 at night. I'm by myself. I'm in a goddamn forest. And I need to get out of here immediately. So I'm trying to like push through the brush, and I was like, oh, I know, I'll go this way. Looks like there's another trail. Like, what am I thinking? So I'm like, start going that way, and something tells me, no, go that way. So I was like, okay. So I'm going that. I'm like jump like big logs and stepping, and then I'm like, oh, I know, I'll go that way still. And it's like, go that way. So I was like, okay, go that way. So I, and all of a sudden I'm standing there and I'm like, oh my God, if I died here, no one would ever find my body. I was like, I need to get out of here now. Oh my God. So I'm like clamoring, like pushing, like trying to run, but I can't. And then I like stopped. Something's like, go that way. I was like, okay. So I go that way. I look over, human skull. And I was like, oh, F word. Try and make this radio appropriate. So I'm like, holy F word. Oh, F. And I'm like, Phoebe, calm down. No, it's fine. You're on Douglas. There were miners here. It's cool. It's an old miner. It's skeleton. He was just gold panning in Lawson Creek once. I was like, oh, good. Okay. And then, but like 2 seconds later, I look over again. Like, I'm like, ah! This is a spinal cord with cartilage on it. Oh, no. So then I was like, ah, okay, I have to get out of here now. So then I'm like, oh, F word. Like, run. And I found the side of this gully. And I climbed up. And I was wearing running clothes, and they were just completely muddy. And I was shaking. And I saw this house. And I was like, I need to call the police. So I ran to the house, knock, 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 knock. And this man opens the door, and he's like, he had a glass of wine. And he's like, can I help you? And I was standing there, and I was like, I just found a human body. And he's like, do you want a glass of wine? And like, my first response is like, yes, give me the whole bottle. But then the second, like, I'm like, no, are you crazy? And then I was thinking, oh my God, this is the killer. This is the killer. So then he's like, I'm like, can I use your phone? I need to call the police and turn you in, you murdering bastard. But then I'm like, yeah, I need to use the phone. So he's like, why don't you go wash your hands? I was like, okay, yep. Okay. You know, as I'm walking backwards to the bathroom, I'm like, I'm keeping an eye on you, man. And so I call the police. I'm like, oh, hey, hello. I found a skeleton. And they're like, are you sure it wasn't a deer, ma'am? I was like, yeah, I'm sure I'm not an idiot. Thank you. It was a human. Please bring the police. And then I had another phone call to make, and it was to my family. And so I called them, like, oh, hey, Dad, you know, whoops. I was not running on the road. I found a body in the woods. Yep, you were right. Don't run in the woods. Okay, yes, come get me. So anyhow, I guess the police came. They found the body. It turned out it was a man who lived right in the neighborhood. And I guess they'd been looking for his body for months. So it turned out, you know, if you do die in that woods, like, no one ever finds your body unless it's me, like, going on a run. But they'd called off the search. I mean, they'd looked for him for a long time. And I guess that brings me to my... how I'm going to tie it all together is that the idea of transitions is really, I think, kind of, you can drive it home here in Juneau, because we're right up against the woods, you know. You feel like you're in such a safe neighborhood, but you just can, like, you know, walk 2 feet down a trail and you end up in, like, the straight-up forest. And so I guess that's my story. And I hope you enjoy it. All right. Thank you.
That's Phoebe Rohrbacher from one of the Mudroom's presentations done this past season. Thanks to Mark Wheeler and Amanda Compton for providing those Mudroom stories all these times for the June afternoon. Studio with us now, we have several 11 and 12-year-old girls from the Gastineau Town Little League hosting their state championship majors, July 13th through 19th. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming down the station today.
Thank you for
having us here.
First, Coach Scott Balovich. Scott, do you want to talk about the tournament, please?
Yeah, sure. The tournament will be starting Friday night at 5 o'clock at Melvin Park 2. It's a best 3 out of 5 tournament. So first team that wins 3 games will be the state champion.
I'm going to ask the players to announce their names at the end of the microphone and what position they play.
Hi, I'm Leah, and I play first base, and I pitch.
Hi, my name's Haley, and I play left field and catcher.
I'm Abby Miners, and I play second base.
I'm Peyton, and I play first.
I'm Rachel McCauley, and I'm a catcher.
I'm Miranda Markovich, and I play first and pitcher.
I'm Morgan Balovich, and I play catcher.
I'm Ashley Sanhurt, and I play pitcher and second.
I'm Sammy Good, and I play shortstop and pitcher.
I'm Allison Ireland Haight, and I play pitcher and outfield.
I'm Megan Dallas, and I play center and shortstop.
Hi, I'm Alondra Echeverry, and I play third base.
Good, everybody. We've got a lot of people in here. Someone else step up the microphone, please, and tell me how the tournament play works, please. Just how does the tournament play work?
So how does the tournament play work? Well, I think, you know, the first night is going to be very interesting. You know, the girls are out there, all going to be very they're going to be very tight, and it's going to be very it's going to be very tight for the girls the first night. They're going to be nervous, but yeah, after the first couple innings, I think that you'll see a lot of really good softball from these girls. They've been working very hard over the last 2 weeks. And I think that Juno, if they come out and they support their Juno softball girls for the state title, they're going to see some really awesome softball.
What teams are they going to be playing against?
Last night we found out who the winner of the district championship tournament up in Anchorage was, and it was a Nunaka Valley team. It's a team that is a combination of City View, Polar, and Nunaka Valley district up there, and the majority of the girls are from Nunaka Valley, so they call the team Nunaka Valley.
And last week I had some of the boys' players on, and they complained that the coaches were kind of tough. And my question to the girls here, are the boys' coaches tougher than the girls' team coaches?
Well, I think that our coach is pretty tough, because if we don't, if he's not tough on us, then we don't really learn anything out of it, and... And if we get in trouble, then we have to run grinders. And that is when you sprint to first, then jog the rest of the way to home, and then you sprint to second, and then jog the way home, and then you sprint to third, and then jog the way home, and then sprint to home, and that's one grinder.
Yeah. I'm going to ask your players to step up to the microphone one at a time and say why Little League play is fun for them.
It's really fun because we just get to be together and have fun playing softball, basically.
Like Morgan said, yeah, you get to be with all your friends, and you get to learn new stuff, and you get to go chances to travel a lot of places. And yeah.
And it's also a challenge at some points when we are playing, but you learn from it, so it makes it more fun as you learn more.
Well, we practically all know each other from a private club that we have, and it's called the Night Suns, and we're all the Night Suns players, so it's pretty much just playing against your Midnight Suns players.
And it's really fun playing with my friends, too.
I like it because you get to meet new people and travel to different places.
I like it because we get to compete with other teams.
I like it because you get to try new positions sometimes, and you can learn a lot of new stuff from it.
I like it because you get to meet a lot of people and you get to travel a lot.
There's a lot of good reasons there. Now I'm going to ask the players to tell me a little bit more about strategies for winning. Baseball is more, and softball is more than just hitting a ball and running around in circles. Is that true? What are some strategies for winning?
To play hard every time, and even if you are losing by a lot or a little, just to keep playing your hardest and not give up.
Don't let something little get to you. Keep it on the field if you have a rough time. Don't bring it home and be all down and everything if you lose or something.
If you mess up, then it's just one thing, so then you don't have to, like, you don't get yourself down on just one thing because you have many other chances.
And to always be confident on the field. ABCs.
ABCs, always be confident. That's good to remember. Coach, you want to give me some more information about the tournament and how people can take part in it?
Well, there are a lot of volunteer opportunities at the ballpark. The Gastineau Channel Little League president and all of the officers will be there. And there are a lot of things like 50-50 raffle. There will be the concession stands will be open. You know, if folks want to show up and the president will be announced at each game. So you'll know who the officers are of Grassno Channel Little League, and then you can go up to them and just say, "Hey, do you need me to do anything?" And it's really a great opportunity to get involved that way. There's quite a bit that goes into a state tournament, and there are a lot of tasks that need to be done, and volunteers are very welcome, very welcome.
How many players are on a team, and what positions are they?
We have 12 girls. We have 6 pitchers. And that's a luxury to have 6 pitchers. Usually you don't have that many. So, they all you know, work together very well. So if one's having a bad day, we can plug another one in there. And usually these kids will, you know, they'll pound the strike zone and throw a lot of strikes. But having 6 pitchers, if you have a pitcher that's having a rough day, you can just plug another one in there, like I said. And that's a very nice problem to have a lot of pitchers. We have, you know, a very balanced defense. We're very deep on defense too. We've got a lot of kids that usually play the infield but are, stationed in the outfield now. We have a lot of athletes on this team, and as a coach, you know, having a deep squad like this can provide, you know, it can provide you luxuries, and then it's also can be very demanding on the coach in terms of, you know, where do you play all these kids? They all deserve to play, and they all deserve to play all the time. So it's a blessing, and then it can be pretty tough sometimes too. But it's a strong squad. These girls have all been together since they were 7 years old, and like one of them mentioned, you know, through the Midnight Suns program, ASA program, these girls have been playing together a long time, and they've been working hard a long time, and you know, they're to the point now where you know, they're very skilled ball players, and it's a lot of fun to watch these kids go out and really play at a high level.
What kind of strategies do you have as a coach to keep them playing at a high level?
Well, like, you know, like any kids, you have to keep them motivated. You have to keep them focused, and we have several methods to do that. I think one of the kids mentioned the grinders, and that is a, you know, you think of the all right, you're not focusing, you're not playing well, drop and give me 20. Well, this is a little bit more intense than drop and give me 20. It's a rather intense base running exercise, and it tends to work. You know, the girls know that if they have to run a grinder, then the coaches aren't very pleased with their work ethic or their focus, and that's a motivational technique. But I don't have to do that very often anymore. The girls are, when they step on that field, they're usually ready to play. They've got the furrowed eyebrows, and they're ready to compete.
All right, and those games are going to take place where? When?
Melvin Park, down at the end of Riverside there. Melvin Park 2, it's the high school field right now for the Juno Douglas Crimson Bears.
All right, it's Coach Scott Bolovich and players the team. Thank you for coming down to the station. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I'll just say come on out, support these kids, and watch some great softball this weekend.
All right, thanks for coming by, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root for the home team. And if they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes you're out at the old ball. Thank you.
Programming support comes from listeners like you and by McDonald's, serving dip cones and s'more pies, plus featuring chocolate chip frappes. McDonald's, open daily in the Valley in Juneau.
Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
We were just leaving the hotel. There was a guy that came running out into the lobby, and he said there's a girl that was drowning in the pool. And that's when I followed, like I dropped everything I had, and I just followed him.
This is 15-year-old Anthony Keller of Wasilla. He's remembering back to a trip he took to Kenai late last year.
Some lady already has jumped into the hot tub and taken the girl out of it, and she was unconscious. After a little bit, like, nobody there knew CPR, and I said that I was certified as a CPR and first aid, and that I can do it, and that's when I gave her CPR, and after a little bit, she pretty much just came back to life.
A few months before this incident, Anthony took a CPR and first aid training course as part of K'nik Tribal Council's Rural Youth Services program. It was by chance that he got the training. He was added last minute to fill up the class. It was also chance that put him in the right place at the right time that day.
After that happened, I noticed that, like, when it comes to a hard situation, I don't get nervous. I just, like, get into it and just do what I have to do.
Kevin Toothaker works with K'nik Tribal Council and says he's really proud of Anthony.
As far as seeing his potential, I like to feel like I'm the weatherman of potential, and I could try to see what people are good at and he's got a good bone. He's got a great soul. He's just a good young man.
At the moment, Anthony is living with his grandparents down south. I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Alaska State Division of Behavioral Health.
Listen, honey, I gotta get away. standing here watching a tail light, as if there's some kind of sign fading into a memory. I just got tired of trying. So long, I hate to see you go, so I save my tears for later on down the road. How come I keep on holding on, knowing you won't be coming home? Later, I get a letter, a picture of a room in some hotel, sitting framed up on the table, a picture I know so well. You painted yourself into a corner, now you're trying to paint something new. And your lipstick on the letter is a goodbye kiss from you. So long, I hate to see you go, but I'll save my tears for later on down the road. How long I keep on holding on, knowing you won't be coming home. Table. Still set it for you and me. It's become a habit, my own personal make-believe.
Something new from Robert Cray. The time is 3:58. You are tuned to KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. The Valley and Ocala area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. An excursion inlet and icy strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. Also online at www.ktoo.org. The forecast for tonight, decreasing clouds with low temperatures around 45 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, increasing clouds with high temperatures around 65 degrees. Forecast for Thursday night, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Friday, rain likely. Looks like Friday night, rain likely. And Saturday, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and high temperatures around 58 degrees. Next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to Juneau Afternoon today. If you'd like to be on a Juneau Afternoon or know someone that should be, give me a call. My name is Jeff Brown. My number is 463-6425.
These battleground states where the Latino population has increased. And that is something that a lot of Latino activists are using to get their voice heard.
We'll hear what they're saying in Arizona about immigration.
Today is Wednesday, July 11th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Coming up...